You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Anka Kempkes. Anka, thanks so much for being with me today.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
I'd like to talk about the gallery, Broadway 1602. Can you tell me a little bit about what's happening right now or what's about to happen? I think you're opening again on September 6th, if I'm correct, but what the next show is.
Yes.
and what your role is there.
Yes, it's a very exciting moment for us, Brainerd, because we have recently moved to a new gallery location in Harlem. We have opened there in May two buildings, two interconnected buildings. One of them is an old firehouse from 1903. And I'm sharing this building with other younger galleries. The first gallery who has joined us there is Tempo Rovato from Tel Aviv, and the gallery has relocated to New York now with this new project in Harlem. And we opened during the time of the free New York Art Fair on Randolph Island, which is geographically very close to our East Harlem location on 121st and 3rd Avenue. And it's a great moment because we feel like we are part of a new start for a new gallery development and scene in Harlem. And we were the first gallery that opened there in March, closely followed by Gavin Brown, who opened there as well, and Elizabeth Dees opening her first show in September as well. And so this is something very new. And we opened with a show there that was centered around two seminal pieces by George Siegel, and because I just started to work with the George Siegel Foundation, and these were two fantastic pieces, one of them called The Man on the Scaffold from 1976 by George Siegel, which was a very good iconic piece for having just been in a big construction site in an old building up there, and it was a wonderful show, and we put these works in dialogue with contemporary artists. We had a roof piece, outer piece by Tom Burr there from New York, and a piece, a wonderful sculpture by Polish sculptor Pavel Althammer. And it was a very rich, very curated show. And now, in September, we're opening the first solo show in this new space in Harlem with New York minimalist Rosemary Castoro, whose work I rediscovered, 2.5, 3 years ago. And we had last fall, we had, after Rosemary passed untimely, sadly, in the spring of the same year, we created her Soho Loft Studio, where she had lived from 1964 onwards, her whole life, lived and worked. And that was a really fantastic project as well. But now in September, this is the first big solo show we have with Rosemary in the gallery after a lot of engagements with the artist. And this is a very very special project that also stands very much for what we are doing, which is that pretty much from the beginning on, when I came to New York in 2005, I focused on women artists from the post-war era, from the 1960s and 70s, whose work I rediscovered and reintroduced to the contemporary art world. And a lot of these amazing female avant-gardists had not received the same recognition like their male peers in the time or later had kind of discontinued careers because there was not the same attention and appreciation for the work of female artists historically at this period. And of course today this is all very changed, and we have been very much part of this work and this new recognition.
And that's very exciting, and of course what I want to talk a little bit more about, so maybe we should talk specifically about this show, because as you're saying, the gallery has a reputation of working with women who are pioneering artists in the field. So this show in September, can you tell us, it sounds like a powerful show. Of course, she's a great artist. Can you tell us a little bit about how that show came together or anything about it?
Yes, the show came together through a lot of research that I have done since I met Rosemary in fall of 2015. And back then, we worked very closely with her. She was still alive. And so I still had the chance to talk with her a lot about the time, about the period, and about her work, and how it came together, and what the situation was back in the 60s when she started Bruce Murray had moved into the Soho loft in 1964, and she was at that time already together with Carl Andre, the New York minimalist. They were married from 61 to 69 in like the heydays of minimalism in New York, and Carl Andre had actually worked and lived also in the studio, in Rosemary's studio. And the studio was pretty much a social hub at the time. It was a big meeting point for the avant-garde at the time of the conceptual and minimal artists, because Rosemary threw a lot of kind of events and parties and dinners there. She was very social, but at the same time, she was a total studio artist. So this space was amazing because it had basically sedimented all these decades of New York, you know, avant-garde history and her work. And so I still had the chance to go very deeply into all of this and into her archive in her presence. And so this show is the result of this whole process. And so we're showing amazing big minimal paintings of hers from the 1960s that many people have never seen since the 1960s, because as I said before, a lot of the women artists didn't have the same recognition and continuous, for example, gallery representations and museums presence, like their male peers, who often, you know, developed this kind of ongoing, what I call style of achievement, because there was this constant attention and recognition. So what happened was that Rosemary had rolled up these large-scale prominent canvases of these amazing kind of pattern paintings and structural paintings she did at the time in the 60s, as part of the height of the argument, the stylistic argument and formalist argument of the time. In her studio, they were rolled up for 40 years, and we were the first to look again at these works. And so one will see in this show five of these prominent minimal paintings in dialogue with a very important group of conceptual drawings, the so-called inventory drawings she made at the time. They were based on a kind of a diaristic personal inventory she made of kind of emotional encounters in her daily life. On each day, she made these indexes, number indexes that categorized certain events and situations she experienced in a day. And then she would transfer this numeric index into vector drawings and structural and conceptual drawings. So also, this whole project of the inventory drawings, which are quite prominent, also in scale, have never been seen as such together. And then in the late 60s, Rosemary did also interventionist work in the city. She did performance work, actions in the city, in downtown. She did concrete poetry, which was politicizing around the time of the Vietnam War. So all these aspects will be to be seen in this show in September.
That's very exciting. It sounds like a very important and very interesting show. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the relationship your gallery has to supporting women artists in historically, but also and perhaps talk about some emerging or newer artists in the time since the gallery began and has refined or continued its mission. There continues to be controversy and still difficulty with women artists having the kind of visibility that men of the same caliber seem to get in the art world. I mean, there's always something coming up. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't Marina Abramović recently saying women don't make it because they have children or something like that, which was kind of really created a firestorm of activity. What have you seen change? And I'd also like to talk about an emerging artist or other artists, but in the time that you've been there, has that changed? Has there been any historical shift in how, because that is the kind of part of the goal of the gallery or the directive, isn't it?
Yes. Well, things have shifted, definitely. There has been changes towards a better situation, a better recognition of women artists, for sure. When I arrived in New York in 2005 and started this work, it was a very good moment and a very important moment for this work, because it coincided with Connie Butler's WAC show, the feminist show about the feminist art movement in New York and in U.S. and internationally. And this was this very big and very thoroughly researched survey show. And there were a lot of artists in this show people had for a very long time not seen and or never heard of. This show took first place when Connie Butler was still at the MoCA Los Angeles, and then it traveled to the PS1 when Connie became curator at the drawing department of MoMA. And I had seen this show in both locations, and it coincided as I sat with the kind of work I was starting to do. At the time, we had a very successful show, which was about Alina Czaporcznikow, a Polish post-war sculptor from who had immigrated in 1964 to Paris. She was a Holocaust survivor. And I did a show with this artist already in the Kunsthalle Basel when I was curator there in Switzerland in 2004. And then I was able to represent the estate in my gallery right from the beginning when I was still a very young gallery, and I had otherwise primarily represented very young emerging artists. And so in winter 2007, we had the first solo show and retrospective show of Alina Czaporcznikow in New York. And that coincided with this new attention of the museums for women artists. So there was a new acquisition activity happening in the museums of completing the gaps in the collections, historical gaps in the collections with women artists. This was the very beginning. And there was, 2 years later, there was a big show, Elle at Centre Pompidou, in the Centre Pompidou Center in Paris, which pretended to be about women artists in the collection, but in actual fact, there was a lot of criticism around this show because you could see on the labels of the exhibits that a lot of the works had been in earlier times been donated to the museum, and then before the opening of this show, there had been a lot of works had been quickly and hectically still collected, been acquired for the collection to make it look a bit more complete. So all these activities were going on, and when we have the Czaporcznikow show, we had a fantastic support from museum's trustees of MoMA particularly, and quite a number of museums in the U.S. started acquiring this work right away, recognizing, with the support of the trustees who recognized it also very much right from the beginning, that this was an artist of an incredible caliber. She was often compared to Louise Bourgeois and Eva Hesse. And this has become like a very important rediscovery history. Later received an U.S. Museum's retrospective with museum as the leading house and the Hammer Museum and the Wexner Center of Art. And so this was the beginning of our work, among other women artists I started working with, like Babette Mengel, the fantastic performance photographer and experimental filmmaker. I had already worked with Babette as a curator in Germany in 1999. I had done her first film retrospective in Germany. And so there were all these things were starting to happen, but it was still a very, very kind of virgin, kind of young situation in terms of the collecting and the general recognition. And then we systematically worked on this with a then more and more extended program of women artists from Europe, from Eastern Europe, from United States, from Brazil as well recently. And now we see that this has become almost like a new collecting area for a lot of collectors who before even like only collected contemporary art and now looking at this interesting work that comes to people completely fresh, completely unintroduced. It's a work that people see for the first time like a young emerging artist and start to, you know, get to know more about and learn about. And so it's exciting because you look at an avant-garde history, you look at an avant-garde work of art from the 1960s or 70s, and it has not been conventionalized through an overexposure or market overexposure with, you know, endless auction house circulations and so on. It's a very interesting history. And what I always say that the women artists, they contribute something so interesting for a young audience today of critics, scholars, and the general audience, because they have to be an avant-garde inside of the avant-garde already at the time. So with all the new kind of discourse we have now, how we look at art from a more emancipatory point of view, what women artists contributed back then already as an alternative language to the general avant-garde or the male-dominated avant-garde is from a today point of view particularly interesting and fresh.
I think you're right, of course, and to speak about what's happening today, and I know this is just one isolated issue, but I think it raised thoughts from a lot of people on the issue. But when Marina Abramović recently said that, you know, the reason more women aren't successful is because they have children, it I think reminded a lot of artists, including myself, of when my wife and I are a collaborative, and when we were talking to different people and having shows in New York and also a child, it was kind of something that we tried to make believe we didn't have, you know. So we'd go to all this work to meet with curators, getting babysitters and everything else, yeah. at tremendous yeah. difficulty and, you know, expense and organization. And the feeling was we didn't want to tell anybody we had a child, as though that would somehow take away from, approaching us like they would any other artist. I don't know, but I would imagine that part of the reaction to Marina's really, you know, what I would think is a kind of naive comment, but that that a lot of artists and other people still feel that pressure today, that they don't have, if you have a child, you don't have the same mobility to go to residencies all over the world or fly anywhere or do things for very little money.
It's a real life issue for sure, but I think it's not such a stigma anymore today. But of course, it's also, I mean, in a place like New York City, it's a matter also of me, no? I mean, to be organized around your career and having a child, and so I do see that this can be a problem. And in actual fact, it's interesting when I now think about it. A lot of the artists I work with from that generation, from the 60s and 70s, they actually don't have children. They actually decided for a more bachelor-esque kind of life. It's quite interesting. And a lot of these women artists from that age group, they're also now, they live on their own, they're single, and it's quite interesting. So there has been obviously a certain consequence back then already, if I'm this kind of, you know, very rigid and uncompromising avant-garde artist, I have to be on my own and I have to do this. Or I went through bad divorces and then I decided I have to totally focus on my work and on my studio practice. And these are not always like kind of the happiest stories, but often they are also very strong and convincing stories in terms of the consequence that was taken for this kind of, you know, incredibly determined form of art production. And I don't know, I think it's still a little bit of an unresolved issue. One can only hope that from now on, you know, that the men pull their 50% in raising a child. So, and I see there's a lot happening now in my generation and younger people's lives, and so that's great. But that, of course, absolutely didn't happen back then, you know. I mean, we have all these stories and all these reports, you know, from female artists who were married back then, often to other artists, peers, or writers, and when there were social gatherings, they were supposed to stand in the kitchen still, or they were, you know, it's like, it was still a very
I think it's still very new. I remember, you know, I mean, of course, I'm a different generation, and you know, when we had a child, I remember my mother watching my wife and I care for the child, and one day she started crying and she said, I've never seen you know, growing up wasn't like this for me, you know, your father did nothing, and for all the husbands I know, they did nothing. And for my generation, I'm not an exception, that the husbands are expected to be taking care of the child, and I suppose that is something that that has changed the kind of burden on women to do what you were saying in this kind of avant-garde trajectory, where if you're serious, you choose not to have a child and perhaps to be single as well because of the demands of a relationship and a child at that point in time.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, it's a negotiation. You know, I have seen in couples where both were like on a very high level career trajectory in the art world that the male partner was willing to cut back to an 80% versus 100%, and the woman went on with 100%. So you see things like this now happening, which is great. And but I think it's very, very new and very recent. And I think there's still like a lot of psychological things happening, you know, like there's still like a little bit of a problem when women make a career and get financially far more independent now than it used to be, particularly in my generation. I think that started it kind of, you know, people are now in their 40s and there's still like, you know, you see still a certain form of, you know, envy of male envy on when this happens. It's not completely guaranteed yet and totally accepted. But I think it's getting better. It's getting definitely better. But when you see how this scene is treated in popular culture, like I don't know if you saw that movie, The Intern. And there we have like this very progressive model of this businesswoman, this young businesswoman, and her husband basically totally cut back his career for raising their child, but then she gets kind of punished by him having an affair. And so it's kind of, I think this is very much negotiated also in popular culture right now, and all these new role models and these new negotiations and how they can be, you know, successful and where they still fail. And, you know, but as I said, this generation of artists I work with from the 60s and 70s, often the consequence was to end up in a quite bachelorette kind of lifestyle of a life in the studio, which I find quite fascinating. This is something, you know, it's also something to highly respect, no? Also a choice.
Sure. Mm-hmm. That's right. Is there also, is for the gallery, is it entirely 60s and 70s artists, or are you also working with emerging artists at this point?
I also work with emerging artists. I have worked for quite some time with Polish filmmaker Anna Molska and with the Canadian painter Paul P. And so these are, and I just started working with a young painter from Sao Paulo, Ana Prata. And there's an ongoing dialogue also with the contemporary art, and actually with the Harlem space, which is, we have like a great spatial situation there with the two buildings and all sorts of different levels and outdoor spaces. We are able to extend the program in various directions. And so that's something I'm very actively working on at the same time right now. So,
so to speak to, yeah, what you are working on at that time, how does the program reach out? Or in other words, how do you find or look for emerging artists in this area, as you were just saying that you're reaching out to, which is just one mm-hmm. aspect of it, I know.
With the young artists, with the emerging artists, it still comes very much through the social connections and travels and, you know, communications, dialogues, people, you know, make you aware of an artist, often through friendships, through social contacts. And then you start to look at the work, you go to the studios, and then if something like really moves you and really, you know, really impresses you and you see something happening there that is very, you know, striking and impressive, then you go deeper into it and you might start working with the artist. So it's quite different, I find, than with the historical program, which is often, in my case, through research and almost scholarly research. And it's also through context, of course, but it's more this way why with the young artists and the emerging artists, it's more so social context and socializing and meeting people and traveling and so on. Like, for example, I'm traveling a lot to Brazil now, and so there's a new connection happening here with artists from, also younger artists from Brazil.
And many of the ways you'll find those, as you were saying, is through social connections and just so for the artists, and there's many people listening to this, artists, curators, and people from the art world of all types, writers and mm-hmm. critics, but to understand more clearly about it, on one level it sounds like it's all very personal, and it is who you know or whether or not those artists are in those particular social circles or get recommended. Mm-hmm. Does it ever happen that you also meet or get to know about an artist through a direct connection, through just seeing their show, or through a letter, or any other means as opposed to a social connection?
Through seeing a show could totally happen, for sure, but then usually there's also already context. Why do you go to see the show in this particular gallery? Because you might have you might already have a relation with this gallery in terms of, you know, you like the program, you like the context. I think it's very context based. Huh? I mean, for me, for sure, this is the way. And there has to be some kind of context that leads you to this artist, and that builds this kind of interest and trust and special focus. And I would not encourage people to just send portfolios to galleries. That's not how it's happening. It's more specific. Yeah, it's more specific, context related. Yeah.
And before we go, I just want to say, I want to ask you a few more questions, but the next show is opening, because people will hopefully hear the interview right about this time, that it's on Tuesday, September 6th, is the opening of the show we've been discussing at the beginning of the interview.
It's September 15th. It's September 15th. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very good. So mm-hmm. everyone will see it September 16th, and now, of course, you're in Harlem. There'll be a link to that. Before we go, I've been asking people what books they're reading, and if you wouldn't mind sharing that with me, I was just wondering what, it could be fiction, it can be off topic, anything at all, but is there a book that you'd want to share with us?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's two very different things, but maybe not so different. The two books I have on my night table at the moment it's a catalog of the Berlin Biennial, the current Berlin Biennial, The Present in Drag, which is the biennial created by the New York Collective DIS. So it's all about post-internet art and that generation. And I was very impressed by this show, I have to say. I really felt that there's something really new happening here. Almost for the first time in a long, I see here a language that is really of a new generation, and that's really embracing very radically the contemporary condition, and it was strangely moving, this show, because really truly post internet. We are not talking here about any fetishization of new technology. We're talking almost more about something very human beyond this. And this was something I was so impressed by, this, that I'm looking at this catalog right now they made and reading it. So that's one book. And then quite different, the other book I have on my table is Kenneth Gross, An Essay on Uncanny Life Puppet. It's a book Douglas Crimp recommended to me. It's a book by a scholar, he's French, somebody also, I think he's also from Rochester University. And it's about the history of puppeteers, of puppet theater. And why do I read this? Because I was introduced to the work of Robert Anton, and we're going to show his work in our uptown, in our Upper East Side gallery this winter. Robert Anton was a very interesting personality of the 70s and early 80s New York life, and he created this experimental theater, puppet theater. So he had his own puppets that he created, and these were these very enigmatic little plays. There were only 15 people who were allowed to be in the room. And it was never allowed to be photographed or filmed. And it's the work somehow reminds me a little bit of Jack Smith or also Stuart Sherman. And he died in 84 of AIDS-related circumstances. And Susan Sontag was very, very close to him and impressed by his work and wrote about his work. Stella Adler gave him a studio to work in. He was acquainted with Fellini, who wanted him to work with him on his film The Clowns, and Walt Disney wanted to work with him, and Hal Prince from Broadway wanted to work with him, but he declined all these approaches because he wanted to be absolutely in his own world and very independent. And so this is a very interesting, very specific, almost kind of underground New York history, and Douglas Crimp recommended this book to me by Kenneth Gross, An Essay on Uncanny Life Puppet. So this is on my table now as well.
Thank you for sharing it with me. I love that particularly the second one. Monica, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure getting to know you, and I'm really excited about your new space, and I'll certainly come to see it, and I hope as many other people listening that can do as well. So thank you again for your conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.